Greetings, fellow constant readers. You are listening or watching The Company of the Mad, the Stand podcast. I'm your host, Jason Seacrest, and I am joined by quite a distinguished panel. I am so excited to have them all here, and I cannot wait to introduce them to you. But before I do, a disclaimer. Ladies and gentlemen, on this podcast, we will be discussing Stephen King's epic novel, The Stand. For this episode, specifically chapters 1 through 24. For those of you who have not yet read The Stand, there may be spoilers ahead, and so we encourage each and every one of you to take the Stand challenge and read along with us each month. We're also super excited to hear your thoughts, so as you are reading, drop us a line by using hashtag TheStandChallenge on Twitter, Instagram, or whatever is your preferred playground for reading biased news and checking in on your exes. A second disclaimer, if you are listening to The Stand podcast on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or any other such audio-only platform, why? Why would you do that when you can come over to thestandpodcast.com and watch the video of our little soiree? Then you can see our gorgeous faces and join in on all of the fun that we'll be having as we discuss a super flu that destroys the majority of the human race. While you're at thestandpodcast.com, scroll down and give a donation to the EMS FDNY Help Fund. Your donation will help those on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. The EMS FDNY Help Fund is putting supplies in the hands of those who need them and providing relief to those infected while working on the front lines in New York City. Mike Flanagan is with us. He is the writer and director of such Stephen King film adaptations as Dr. Sleep and Gerald's Game, as well as the hit Netflix TV show, The Haunting of Hill House. He is currently finishing up production on Netflix's The Haunting of Bly Manor. Tanana Reeve-Dhu is a novelist and the producer of Shudder's Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror. She teaches Black Horror and Afrofuturism at UCLA, and you can take her online digital download course, The Sunken Place, by going to TananaReeveDhu.com. I'm going to take it. You should too. Tanana Reeve has been reading Stephen King books since she was a little girl. She'll talk with us a bit about that later in the hour. And she has played with Stephen King on stage as part of the Rock Bottom Remainders. Anthony Bresnikan is an author and journalist who has worked as a reporter for just about everyone. The Arizona Republic, Associated Press, USA Today, and Entertainment Weekly, just to name a few. Bresnikan's debut novel, Brutal Youth, is a funny, tough, and heartbreaking book about the darker side of growing up. It received high praise from critics and peers alike, including Stephen King, who provided a blurb for the novel's dust jacket. Bresnikan is currently the Los Angeles correspondent with Vanity Fair. I'm your host, Jason Seacrest. I write scary stuff, and I write about scary stuff as well. I'm an author of horror fiction, and I write a column for King's limited edition publishers called What I Learned from Stephen King, exploring the wisdom, life lessons, and spirituality in King's many works. You can hear me read those columns to you and get all my horror fiction when you subscribe at patreon.com/Jason Seacrest. Now, that's a hard name to spell, and Tanana Reeve-Dhu isn't that much easier. So you'll find the links to all these things and more at thestandpodcast.com, right under the Meet the Panel section. Okay, so since this is the first episode, before we dive right into talking about this month's chapters, I'd like to take a moment to get to know each of you a little bit better. So I'm going to ask each of you two questions, starting with Mr. Flanagan. How did you first come to love Stephen King? And when was the first time you read The Stand?
Oh, well, I think I first fell in love with Stephen King. I was in fifth grade-ish, and the first King book that I read was It. I really kind of jumped into the deep end on it. And I had been, growing up, I read a lot of John Bellairs and then R.L. Stine and Christopher Pike. But I was terrified of scary movies. I couldn't handle scary movies. And I thought rather naively that if I instead would focus on scary books. That would be better because I could control the experience and I could shut the book. And because I wasn't seeing it and hearing it and being startled, you know, on screen, it would be less traumatic. And I was completely wrong about that. So I started with it, and I didn't want to keep reading it. It was so upsetting, but I loved the characters so much that I didn't have a choice. And so I kind of endured this huge novel that was utterly unlike anything I'd ever read, and, you know, simultaneously kind of traumatized me and opened my eyes to horror fiction. And by the end of it, I felt like I had survived this ordeal with the Losers Club. And from then on, I was a King fanatic. And The Stand, I read, my introduction to The Stand was I watched Mick Garris's miniseries when it first aired and loved it. And it was a few years later, I finally got around to reading the book. And I haven't read it since then, which would have been, I would have been in high school, I think, when I read that.
That was in the 90s, I think, right? Like when the miniseries came out?
Yes. And I, it must have been a year or two after I saw the miniseries that I finally read the book and loved it, but I haven't picked it up again because I tried to burn my way through the entire Stephen King catalog. I tried to read his whole library, and that took years and years and years. So I this is the first time I've circled back to The Stand.
Have you read everything? Have you read everything by Stephen King at this point?
Yes. Yes, wow. I have.
That's incredible. Yeah. That is absolutely amazing. Tanana Reeve, what about you? What made you fall in love with Stephen King, and when was the first time that you read The Stand?
Well, I grew up with my late mother, Patricia Stevens Due, who loved horror, which is kind of funny. She was a civil rights activist. So she was known as a very serious-minded person, but she basically raised me and my sisters on those old Universal horror movies, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and The Mummy, and The Fly, and all this stuff. So I got my love of horror from her, and she bought me my first Stephen King novel when I was in high school. That would have been The Shining, is my memory of it. And as an aspiring writer, especially one who had never read horror, you know, I had been exposed to cinematic horror, but I had never, maybe I had read The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, maybe, that's about it. I had never read, I can't think of any horror literature I had read. So The Shining just rocked my world. It was a masterclass, as all of King's work is, on building characters that readers will love. So it didn't matter that there weren't any characters in The Shining who reminded me of me or seemed like me. You know, there was no little girl or anything like that, but I was in the Overlook Hotel. I was with those characters. He even mentioned my favorite TV show, Emergency, at the time.
Wow.
So I almost fell out of my bed when I read that. It was like the book had reached into my life and grabbed me by the hair. Oh my gosh. So The Stand came a bit later. I'm guessing I was still in high school. So it was, I'm not going to say what year, but it was a while back. And I was sick when I read it, which is an issue I'm dealing with now, but not because I'm sick, but because I'm afraid of getting sick during an infection. So I had either a flu or a cold while I was reading it. And I thought every symptom I read in the book, I had Captain Trips. So it's kind of funny to be doing this book club right now because
oh my gosh,
the Stand is the last book I would have picked up at this particular moment in history, just because, you know, when things first started, we all thought it was kind of fun to watch Contagion and all the pandemic movies. And I was recommending my short stories I've written about pandemic. I have one called Herd Immunity I keep recommending. But in recent weeks, it's been all about the hypochondria, you know, like setting up my temperature with stress. So it is really, really hard for me to read The Stand right now. But also, like Mike, I haven't read it since high school. So it's fascinating. It's fascinating comparing then and now, seeing the masterwork in terms of creating characters, which is what I feel like Stephen King was almost like my personal writing instructor on that, because it was like, yes, that's what I want. I want my characters to be so real that even people who don't like horror have to read my book because they have to find out what happens next.
I love that. That's perfect. That's what you strive for, as a writer. Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely perfect. Anthony, what about you? How did you come to love Stephen King, and when did you first read The Stand?
Yeah, well, before I answer that, you were kind enough to mention my book and the shout out I got from him, but look who else has a really great shout out. Tanana Reeve's book, My Soul to Keep. And I love her books, and so it's a pleasure to be with her and Mike and you to talk about this.
That's awesome.
I think, okay, so I got into Stephen King when I was about 12 or 13. I went to I loved going to movies, and I went to see a movie with my friend, and there was a trailer for Pet Sematary, and I was not into horror. I wasn't into Freddy or Jason or any of that stuff at that point. This would have been like 1988 or something. And but there was something about the trailer for that just looked so cool. I love the idea of there being this thing in the woods, this little burial ground, you know, that you could explore and find these sort of ruins out there. And the old guy kind of reminded me of my grandfather. You know, I just felt like drawn to this story. But because it was an R-rated horror film and I was 12 years old, no adult would take me to see it. And my grandmother said, you know, I spent a lot of time with her, and she said, you know, that's a book by this guy named Stephen King. How about if we buy you the book? And I was so disappointed to get a reading assignment. I just wanted to watch the movie, and reluctantly, okay, fine, I guess I'll read this book. And she bought it for me. I still have it. I have it in a little glass box. It's all beat up and torn and falling apart. This old paperback of Pet Sematary, and it gave me a sense of power as a kid. At that age, nothing you do is your own will. You're told what to dress, where to be, when to speak, when not to, when to eat. Like, you're constantly being bossed around. But I was really impressed that this guy Stephen King could write a story and using nothing except words, make me believe things and make me see things and make me feel things. And I really wanted that. And I was kind of a lost kid. I was, you know, troubled and didn't have the greatest home life, but writing really gave me a sense of control that I could write a story, and it might be bad, but it's not wrong. And so I would write my little ghost stories, and then the girl I liked in eighth grade knew that I liked Stephen King, and she bought me It. The paperback for It, which was as a Christmas present. So like those were my first two books by him. And then I would scrape together cash, whatever money I could find in the couch cushions or on top of the dryer that fell out of the clothes doing the laundry. Like, I would scrape together $6.99. And when we would go to the Giant Eagle grocery store, if I had enough for a paperback, I would buy them. So I gradually collected whatever they had available, Christine and then The Stand. So I think I read The Stand, probably was about the fifth or sixth book of his that I've read. I used to read them so much that I would put the contact paper on the outside to keep them from falling apart. So that's what's holding this one together. One of the ones I bought at the grocery store.
That's a great cover that you have there too, that artist Don Brodigam did. I mean, that's one of the best covers of The Stand that there is. You also, you had quite a bit of great news that you were able to break this week, didn't you, Anthony?
Yeah, well, you know, ever since they began work on this new adaptation of The Stand, I wanted to learn more about it, see some imagery, and at Vanity Fair, we did the first look of The Stand. It's part of our new TV issue that's coming out. And, you know, so we have it in print, but then we also put a bunch of images and a story online. I talked to Steve about it. We can call him Steve here. We're all friends, right? I talked to the showrunners and Whoopi Goldberg and Odessa Young, who plays Franny. Whoopi, of course, plays Mother Abigail. And, it was great. The story really went wild this week. That was a lot of fun to share something with the Stephen King fans out there.
That's amazing. And if people want to see the first look at the new miniseries of The Stand, they can go to vanityfair.com.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Awesome. Thanks, amazing. The first, I would say that for me, the first time that I fell in love with Stephen King was probably at, I was about 10 years old when I read It. And I read it because I had seen the miniseries with Tim Curry scaring the living hell out of me, popping up in the storm drain. I was one of those kids who, you know, the amazing thing about that miniseries is that it aired at a time slot where kids were still awake, which was unheard of at that time. And it was no kid could talk about anything at school the next day except Stephen King's It. I mean, it was utterly terrifying. And I raced out and bought the paperback with Tim Curry's glaring face, you know, on the cover, and was terrified just to hold it, and yet also felt this strange sense of protection as I was holding it. And if there had been a losers club at my school, I would have been happy to join. I mean, that's definitely the kind of kid that I was when I was growing up. And I think that it also taught me a lot about the power of metaphor, in that Pennywise is sort of this representation of fear and can take the form of whatever it is that scares you. And that was so powerful to me. You know, I mean, I'd been a voracious reader from a really young age. My stepfather was the kind of man who would give me The Old Man and the Sea to read when I was 7 years old. Like, it was ridiculous. And
it's thin.
Yeah, exactly what he said. And I was like, I don't understand half the words in this. So he gave me a dictionary and said, then look them up. So I'd been reading books like that since I was very young, but I didn't want to be a writer until I read Stephen King. It seemed like his characters were the first that I felt the most able to relate to. And so in school, when I was 10, our teachers had us write a letter to our hero. And I chose as my hero Stephen King. And I sent him this letter. And along with the letter, I sent him the first short horror story that I'd ever written, which was all of about 2 pages long. And I was shocked to come home from school one day and find a lovely postcard from him in the, he used to send out these typed postcards that he would sign. And he was so kind and so generous and encouraged me to keep writing. And I think that that response gave me the confidence to never stop writing, to do exactly what he told me and never stop writing. And I think without that, you know, 5 years later, 5 years after that, I became a published journalist at 15 years old for Cine Fantastique and Femme Fatales magazine and that sort of thing. And I don't think that I would have done that at that young of an age if I hadn't had that kind of encouragement. So that was sort of where I first started reading Stephen King. And then the truth is that I didn't read The Stand until a few years ago, but there's such a massive difference between reading The Stand a few years ago and reading The Stand now. Like, it feels to me completely different. When I read The Stand before, it seemed like it was a fantasy novel. It seemed like a post-apocalyptic fantasy. And now, as I'm reading it, it's like, this feels like it could happen tomorrow. It makes it all the more terrifying. In fact, in the first 24 chapters that we've just finished reading, I think maybe the only real fantastical element of it is the Randall Flagg levitating off the ground. You know, I don't think there's a single thing that I can think of in the rest of the novel that is fantasy. And it's so much more terrifying to read it now than it was then. Did you, Tanana Reeve, did you find there to be a difference reading it now than when you read it when you were a little girl?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, it feels like it's ripped from the headlines, and so many elements. There are some differences, like the government crackdown looks different, thank goodness, in the world of The Stand than it does in our lives. But also, we do have, attempts by the government to kind of downplay it, like early on, downplay the disease, and we're still having trouble getting enough tests. So we do have a government that is hostile to the truth in the way that the government in the book is hostile to the truth, except in the book, it's more violent, and it involves murdering citizens and murdering people who dissent. So, But aside from that, it is, yeah, it's the stuff of nightmares. And what I find especially, what really pops out for me as sort of an online activist is one of the places that has become a real hotbed, unfortunately, for infection is in our prison system. You know, and there was recently an article saying that in some prisons, like where they tested up to 65% of the inmates were testing positive for COVID-19. And this is a huge, huge crisis. And as a kid, I didn't pay much attention to those guys in the jail cell. You know, they were a-holes, right? We don't like them. They were mean to Nick. But as I'm rereading it now, I'm feeling like that parallel, you know, okay, yeah, they're a-holes, but you don't get the death penalty for beating somebody up and stealing their money, right? And it's kind of that same parallel that we're seeing in our prison system. And I don't even believe in the death penalty, but even if I did, it's not a death penalty offense to do what the vast majority of prisoners have done. So to leave the elderly, the infirm, the immunocompromised, people who are just close to getting out but can't get permission to get out. There's so many horror stories coming out of that. So that has just really jumped out at me, sort of how I think almost accidentally, really, this novel has brought to light a very serious social issue as we're facing the real life pandemic. And that jumped out a lot.
Anthony, did you feel that it was different this time around reading it?
A little bit. I thought, for all the things that Tanana Reeve just said, yeah, you start to notice little things jumping out. Even at one point, someone is outside and they hear birds twittering. And I was like, oh, twittering makes an appearance in 1978. the way people are grasping at information as the virus is spreading in the book reminds me a lot of the way we did in March. You know, I had friends who were sick in New York who thought, well, maybe this hydrochloroquine is the cure. I need to get some. Like, my doctor has prescribed it, but I can't get it unless I get a test. And there's this uncertainty. And now we're hearing, well, maybe that medicine isn't really what you should be taking. Maybe that makes it worse. And, you know, you should wear a mask. You should not wear a mask. Now you should wear a mask again. Like, there's so much back and forth. And I think the confusion and the fear that comes from not knowing is what really stood out as being very prescient on his part. You know, I think one of the things that makes him a great storyteller is that he's very empathetic and that he knows how people feel, including how people who are cruel feel, like how they act toward people. I thought one of the really shocking things in the book is some of the casual racism that the characters express. And sometimes I think that's because he goes inside the head of a not very nice person, but then you see Larry Underwood's mom saying some pretty rotten stuff. She has a problem with Black people and Puerto Rican people. And I think, I don't believe that Steve is like that, you know, but I think he's aware of how people are, good and bad, and the ugliness that is within seemingly decent people and the decency that's sometimes in bad people. And I think that's what this whole book is actually about, because as we know, and we're getting maybe a little ahead of our 200 pages here, but the plague is really only the first third of the book. And the rest is about what happens when you have no rules, when there is no society and nobody's keeping you in line, when you can do anything you want, what do? And some people are drawn to still do the right thing, to still do what's good for other people, what's generous or what's self-sacrificing. And then others are like, now's my chance to take what I want and live how I feel like. And if that means being cruel or that means being selfish, then so be it. Very few of those people, of the evil people in the book, are like Lloyd, you know, like a thrill kill, serial killer. They're often just sort of ordinary people who are indulging their dark side or their mean side or their selfish side. And even Lloyd himself, at times, you see him questioning maybe as the book will go on, whether he really wants to be on this team or not. But I thought that the college thugs that Tanana Reeve brought up, who beat up Nick, and you know, pleading to get out. You know, I don't know. I wouldn't say they're redeemed, but they're definitely sorry for what they did, you know, and they don't want to die. And I think it's nice that when he does finally let them out, that they don't attack him. You know, he's afraid of that. And instead they are true to their word. Like they want to go out and then they get out into their dead town and they can't believe what they see. So, I think that's what stands out for me. And when I wrote about the series, that's what I tried to explore, is that he didn't call it the plague. It's not called the virus. It's not called the end of the whole mess. That's a different story of his. It's called The Stand, and it's about standing up and doing what's right. And I think that's really what he's interested in time and again in his books.
It is interesting. I was thinking as you were saying that there's sort of a thread that goes through, at least I think I noticed it at the end of chapter 3, but it probably goes on for longer than that. There's this sense of, Norm is angry because they're so poor that his wife mm-hmm. has to go babysit for a buck and has left him with the kids all day. Franny is... I think there's something in her, it's very subtle, but I think there's something in her that is worried that if she keeps this child, that she may just never get out of this town and might just end up being one of these locals forever. There's this moment where she's looking at all of these empty apartments that are soon to be filled by the swells who swoop into town when it's season. And she's also in the same time thinking when that happens, the guy who's in the parking lot attendant will have the lowest IQ in the city. And I think there's a part of her that's worried that she may never get out and might just end up having sealed her fate, being one of these locals forever. Stu Redman never got out of town. Stu Redman is a good old boy who didn't get to go to college because he had to take care of his brother, and he let his brother go to college. And so instead, he spends his evening at the filling station with the boys. And there's this sense of poverty and how it impacts the quality of one's life and how it impacts what they believe their own value is also. And it's just so funny to be reading these chapters and realize that none of it's gonna matter. A hill of beans, like everything that they're angry about or that they're worried about, no matter what. Larry Underwood, he's just finally made it. He has money now, you know. And it's like, whether you have money, whether you don't have money, whether you are, no matter what your job is, it doesn't matter. It's all going to come down to the fundamental of your inherent goodness or your lack thereof. And that's all that's gonna matter moving forward.
Or your selflessness. You know, what you're talking about there is Franny saying, am I gonna get to live my life or am I gonna be stuck taking care of a child now?
Totally.
And Stu, the same sort of thing. He George Bailey'd himself, you know, from It's a Wonderful Life. He stayed behind to help people out, and now he's sort of stuck there. And Larry Underwood, like you said, everything they were worried about is going to evaporate. You know, he's worried, is he going to be able to pay his drug bill?
What it's done is it's a complete, that is a difference between this and COVID-19, because, you know, here in The Stand, it does come down to, what are you made of? Are you made of goodness and selflessness, or are you made of selfishness? And
that's why
COVID-19, we've got the haves and the have-nots in a way. So
that's why that line is so important, that the woman that Larry sleeps with, and she shouts at him, "You ain't no nice guy. You ain't no nice guy." Like, yeah. He's like, "No, I'm all right. Like, I'm all right." But he's not. He's very selfish. And his journey in the book is to be a nice guy. Is to be a good guy. So,
Mike, you have a really fascinating look at and a take on reading horror in horrific times. And I'm wondering how you are taking reading a book like this in the middle of a pandemic. I've heard you say in the past that The amazing thing about reading horror in horrific times is that you can close the book and that there's a the end to the book, you know. That's not the case with the horrors of real life. How's it been different for you reading it this time versus last time?
Well, this is, you know, I think as kind of everybody's acknowledged since we started talking, this is a very unique time to be reading this story. Typically, I would feel like a story like this, you know, in the same way I think all great horror is a controlled exercise in bravery, you know, that it's about enduring this chapter or this scene or this movie and making it to the credits or closing the book and being, you know, 2% braver for it. I really believe that's the function of the genre, so that we can actually stretch that muscle and engage in the horrors of the real world. I think there's something unimaginably unique about reading a story whose entire escapist hook, at this point anyway, in the narrative is about a global pandemic and closing the book to look out the window at the global pandemic. You know, that's an enormously strange experience. It's like if you were reading it and you put the book down and it's like, oh man, that was intense, and then leaned over to the demonic clown next to you and was like, I know, right? Like, it was really kind of surreal. What I think is striking me so much about this read on it, other than, you know, it's amazing to watch how King approaches this story structurally, which I think is incredible, that he starts so intimately with Campion and his family, and from there is telling an expansive story that suddenly is introducing this huge ensemble and jumping back and forth among all of them, even if just to touch base with someone while they die. But the feeling I'm getting when I read it is the same feeling I get if I go outside and there's a storm coming, and it's that sense of like the static electricity in the atmosphere, and the way he jumps you around the narrative creates that sensation in a way that I think is so neat now, because if I go outside, I feel like the storm's here. So there's a whole extra kind of gear of irony to this experience that's never really been part of the story for me before, but it didn't really grab me by the throat and hold on until we got to the eighth chapter, which we started to talk about offline right before the podcast actually started, and Anthony pulled out a quote from the end of that chapter that was a line that just gave me goosebumps when I read it, and it's what's so amazing about this chapter now is it's just about the spread of a virus, and it's seeing how it exponentially moves from person to person and how one person can become this kind of pyramid chain of infection. And it just acts that principle out in a very dispassionate and unemotional way, which was to me horrifying. And it ended on a note where someone infected left a dollar tip for a waitress, and Anthony said it right away. The line is, you know, the dollar was crawling with death. And, you know, that these moments in the book, when I read it half my life ago, certainly did not hit me the way they're hitting me now. And that there is so little difference between a chapter like that and the evening news, which has a much higher body count than this story does, where we are right now, you know, in chapter 24. The stand hasn't quite caught up to us. It hasn't quite caught up to COVID yet. And that to me is profoundly strange and scary. But you know, it's certainly so yeah, it kind of works against my big thesis of what I get from horror, you know, of that cathartic kind of controlled escape from reality that's meant to arm you for reality, and that's meant to kind of help train you to be just a little more courageous when it really matters. This is different somehow, because it's, you know, at least so far it's worse here than it is in the book. But you know, I do know it's gonna thankfully the tables will turn and this will start to feel like escapism really soon. And I felt relieved when Randall Flagg levitated and I was like, oh, thank God, you know, finally we're getting into some magical realism and it's going to feel a lot less familiar. So that was a refreshing moment for me of like, oh, thank God we're getting into something less us.
Can I add something here? So I'm reading the unexpanded version, which is about, I think, maybe 200 pages shorter.
At least.
Yeah.
Oh, at least. Closer to 400.
Maybe 400.
Closer to it's more than 400 pages shorter.
Yeah. And chapter 17, when Randall Flagg appears for the first time, he doesn't levitate.
He does not levitate in the original version.
It ends with, so the whole chapter is about him, how he has this jean jacket full of pamphlets, and all of the pamphlets are radical pamphlets, from the Klan to,
his politics were all over the place.
Well, that was the thing, was Randall Flagg doesn't have politics. He right. just goes wherever the most extreme violence prone people are. And he's kind of a blasting cap for them. Like he's even involved in the Patty Hearst kidnapping and the assassination of JFK. Like he has a pamphlet in his pocket that Lee Harvey Oswald gave him. And so you realize he's this low level sort of entity. And he went to high school with Charlie Starkweather.
That was a great detail.
He's like this Zelig-like figure who's floating around. And only at the end it says, because he senses this wave coming, right? There's this mass death that's coming. And he says something like, it was almost time to be reborn. He knew. Why else could he suddenly do magic? And that's where the chapter ends. So he doesn't float yet. Wow. I don't know if that does maybe the floating comes later.
It was right there. He has that thought and then he just kind of lifts off the ground and he's like, this is great. And then he kind of settles back and keeps going.
So,
that's a pretty profound difference right there.
Cause well, I read that. He reminds me a little bit of
magic or yeah. Like
that's what you get for reading the short version. Yeah. Andy. But, I want to go back to,
Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I finished that thought because I was gonna hear about it.
That's why I wanted to read the old version, was because I knew you guys were reading the new version and I was curious where they separate. Another thing that's different is this doesn't start with Campion. It starts with the good old boys in Texas. And he just crashes into the pumps. And then the only time you learn that there is a lab is the government officials who are watching the closed circuit TV and the guy with his face in the soup in the cafeteria and all that. But it's interesting what he left out and what I think a lot of that stuff is really valid and I'm glad it's back in.
It's funny because all I remember, I read the original abridged version and then Steve, as we'll call him, came back and published all of the stuff that had been edited out. So I did go back and read it right away. But it's funny, all these years later, the only thing I remember being different is like lots and lots of descriptions of burying bodies.
Yeah.
And clearing out houses like page after page. But I wanted to go back to like this question of how it feels to read this now. And Mike, you raised such a good point about how horror is supposed to be that escapism, you know, that gives us strength to face a world that isn't as bad as the one that's in the book. And it's a little awkward to try to do that when the world does feel worse than the one in the book. But the one piece of comfort I took from that same chapter you're talking about is how much more virulent, at least, Captain Trips is, right, than COVID-19. Because I'm one of these people, I'm still wiping down every delivery. I'm dreading my trip to the grocery store tomorrow. I wear the hat, the mask, I wash my hair, my clothes, the bottoms of my shoes, everything.
So you're smart. Yeah, you're doing it right. Yeah.
It's like you leap the spacecraft and come back to the chamber where you like, you know, you get but that chapter, when I was reading about how easily it was spreading from person to person, I was like, Woo! Well, at least we're not there. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because I just saw a study now where maybe each infected person is only infecting one other person, whereas at the beginning of this crisis, it was three other people. And in the stand, it is way more than that. It is like literally...
That's like 99.4%.
If you have somebody with this thing, you are done. The whole diner. Like, the whole diner. And I was like, okay, well, whew, thank goodness. Finally some escapism, because... It's not quite that bad for us right now.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent point. And the moment in the very beginning of this version, which Anthony missed out on.
Anthony
had to be different. He had to do it his own way.
I thought it would be fun to find the differences too.
It is actually. It is fun.
Oh, it's so fascinating to me. Campion in the beginning, when he comes running in to get his wife and his daughter to get out of the base, because he's the only one that knows something's gone wrong and that the virus has gone out. And he says to her, before he decides, she says, where are we going? And he said, before I can tell you that, I have to check the wind. And he goes out and actually has to decide which direction to drive based on the direction of the wind, which, you know, from a kind of virulent point of view is really chilling, that this virus is airborne for long distances and can literally be carried to you on the breeze.
Spreading on the wind, literally.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that you're absolutely right, is much scarier than what we're really dealing with now in a world where I read something today that said something, they're saying it might be as high as 35% of all the infected people with COVID may never be symptomatic. And I think, you know, that's scary from a transmission perspective, but it's also a bit reassuring that, you know, you've got a 1 in 3 chance, essentially, that you're never going to feel it, much less be in any, you know, life-threatening danger. It's just more about who you then communicate it to that's disturbing. But yeah, so there are definitely, there are some bright spots in how... And how much more horrible it is in the book here and there. So there's that to hold on to.
Yes. So. Well, it's such an interesting parallel too, because, you know, the protagonists are the survivors, you know, the ones who are naturally immune, and being asymptomatic is like a version of, frankly, of being immune. If it's not going to have any impact on you, if you don't know you have it, you might as well not have had it, except that you can spread it, which is horrifying. And that randomizing factor, like who gets it, who feels it, who ends up on a ventilator, who only has a couple of weeks of feeling under the weather. It's, you know, it's all over the place in terms of the reports. And I've had to really train myself not to to read those close to bedtime too. So I can't read the stand and I can't read the news before I go to sleep at night.
I know. You really should just not bother trying to go to sleep.
I love listening to these two people who made their careers scaring the hell out of people. Like, how afraid they are. Come on, jump it up. You can do it.
But I don't know if you all find this is true. I'm with a bunch of horror heads. Having a horror writer's imagination is not helpful.
No, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. No, I'm literally, I can't, I'm just like you. I'm wiping down every package I get. I wash my hands. You know, they say you're supposed to wash your hands for like 20 seconds. I wash my hands until my knuckles crack and bleed. Like, I'm not freaking kidding you. Like, I wash my hands. I've never washed my hands so much in my life. Like, I wash them 3 times when I come in just from walking the dog and I had gloves on. Like, it's ridiculous. Because why not? Because why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you take every possible precaution that you can? Why wouldn't you wear 2 masks?
Why indeed?
But you know.
You know, the scariest part of any story is when the storyteller leans into the fire and says, "And it happened not very far from here."
Isn't that true?
And that's sort of what we're living with this book. It happened not very far from here.
You know, I would say it's interesting that you mentioned that scene in particular at the beginning, Mike, that isn't in the original text, and also the levitation, which isn't in the original text. While I was reading it, I went back and forth between the 1990 uncut version and the original first edition. And I found I would say that, I mean, I want to say that there's, in what I read in the first 200 pages of the unabridged version in chapters 1 through 24, I want to say that almost 40 to 50% of it was not in the original. And I tell you, yeah. And I think I'll give you three examples. And, you know, because I keep getting asked also a lot on Twitter, people are saying, which version do you like more, or what is the difference between the two? And for me personally, the difference is that the unabridged version is more heartbreaking. The stuff that was not included, Vic's magic hour, Vic Palfrey's magic hour, where he starts to hallucinate after he's been infected with this thing, that's not in there. He has this sort of, he starts to hallucinate, he starts to hear voices of his mother. And what was so terrifying to me about that also is that, you know, I know a family that has recovered from COVID-19, and they were very young. I mean, the mother's in her 30s and the father's in his 40s, but he did hallucinate, and there were times that he was completely unresponsive when she would speak to him. He was very disoriented, and so that just almost brought me to tears. Then there's the what Steve refers to, if we're all calling him Steve, but what Steve refers to as the Anne Radcliffe gothic-like moment of Franny telling her mother that she's pregnant. That's not in the original. No, that's not in the text either.
Good. When you talk about how Steve can spin a character's history in a way that makes it so crystal clear kind of who they are and what they're afraid of. I thought that it must have been 4 pages that he gave to Fran's mother's parlor.
The sitting room. Gosh.
Yeah. Parlor. What that room meant to her, going all the way back to when she was a little girl.
Yeah.
That's the kind of King character work that I find so incredible. And it makes me sad that Anthony hasn't gotten to enjoy this.
Well, you've read it before. Yeah, you just, yeah. But you know, Mike, I have to ask you too, because there is this long history in film, as I'm sure you're aware of mother-daughter scenes on the stairs. And this moment where the mother is so hysterical that she has been slapped in the face by the father. She's on the floor and she gets up and she says, I have to go lay down. And she gets on the stairs and she walks. And I just keep picturing it as this, what an amazing cinematic moment it would be to have Franny at the bottom of the stairs, looking up at her mother, who is so hysterical on the top of the stairs. And she turns around, and King says that she wobbles, that there's this sort of like,
falls. Yeah.
That she almost just tumbles on down the stairs, and she opens her mouth like she's about to say something and just turns around and walks into the bed. And I'm like, this is the most dramatic moment. And like, this is just ripe for cinema. Like, this is just perfect. Are there any moments like that that you're reading that you're like, damn, I want to shoot that. Like, that would just be great to come.
Oh yeah, are you kidding? Yeah, no. I mean, Jesus, so many. It's a remarkably cinematic novel, and one of the things that's amazing about it is how cinematically it is edited. You can feel the rhythm of the cut accelerating as you read it, just chapter to chapter, when he chooses to bounce back and forth between different characters. One of the things that did occur to me more than a few times reading this was what a solid job Mick Garris did with his adaptation, even with the limitations of a television budget, which at the time meant something very different than it means now. You know, network standards and practices that forced him to make it acceptable for prime time, which meant, you know, this is a PG experience basically, on a hard R story. There were stretches of the book as I read it that were verbatim, you know, the way he approached them for the adaptation, and that I thought was really impressive. And so, yeah, you know, if Josh Boone and company weren't already about to unveil this brand new updated version of The Stand, which couldn't be more timely. I would be all over trying to find a way to be able to shoot some of these sequences, because it is so remarkably, remarkably cinematic. And especially for TV now, you know, that long form storytelling, like,
now's the time.
Yeah, totally. Golden age of long form TV.
I mean, each of these characters, you know, and some of these big moments could be worthy of its own movie. You know what I mean? Like Nick and the jail cell and the sheriff and his wife and that whole section where you walk out and the town has fled or everyone has died. That would be a great movie just by itself.
Stu Redman's battle of wits with the scientists who resent him for being healthy but are trying to study him.
Right.
It's its own three-act incredible story. And they got toward the very end of this chunk, they left that detail in where they say, you know, they actually injected him with the virus.
Yeah.
They got so sick of him being immune. It was such a beautiful moment. They said, you know, they got so sick of it. Finally, they just walked up and told him it was a sedative and injected him with the pure form of the virus, like the most potent, you know, Project Blue version of it. And they said, and he killed it without even knowing he had it. He just killed it and they don't understand it. It's like that stuff was so great. And think of the Blumhouse movie. That's just inside his
itself. It's still that story, a story in and of itself. I keep picturing, this is terrible. I keep picturing Franny's father as William Wyndham, Seth from Murder, She Wrote, the doctor on Murder, She Wrote. And because I'm picturing him now, I realized that I started picturing Franny's mother as Vera Miles in Psycho 2. And so I realize that now that my imagination is actually a casting director from 1983. I never knew that. But there is, I feel like the characters in general are just so human and so alive. I mean, Franny's father has this sort of moment where he speechifies on abortion. And I mean, you know, my beliefs are very different from his, that's for sure. But at the same time, his, the way
he talked about his dead son.
The way that he describes his dead son.
It wasn't like an anti-choice thing. It was just like...
You can't fault him for his belief.
And I thought, absolutely.
There's such a great line in there too, where he says that an old man trying to give a young daughter advice is like a monkey trying to teach table manners to a bear. And it's like, but it's like that's part of, coming back to what you said before, Anthony, it really is part of what the book is about, I think, is this... King has a way of having you forgive people of their flaws, and that when you know someone's backstory, when you know why they have a belief system that they have, it starts to not matter if it matches with your own, because you understand why they came to that place. And it's not always the case, of course, but it is certainly the case with his father there. And I personally find that Franny's chapters in particular, I have that thing happen to me where it really only can happen to you with a book, I think, where you just completely lose yourself. You're just completely lost in this other world. And that, it just sucks me in every chapter with Franny, with Franny's father, with Franny's mother, and even when she's talking to the boyfriend, anything with her, I'm completely lost in. Anthony, is there any character for you that you particularly just end up getting completely lost in the middle of their chapters?
Well, he's not the character I would say I like the best, but I'm really fascinated by Harold Lauder, because to me, he's also, I think he has a lot, there's a lot about him I think that's relevant now. We'll get to what happens to him later. But he's a guy who I think, kind of like Larry, is on the fence between potentially being good, doing some good things, and then his other instincts kick in and he goes the other way. And look, I think this is something that's throughout King's work. And our two other guests here, Mike and Tanana Reeve, like they've explored this in their own work. Mike and his adaptations of Gerald's Game and Dr. Sleep, but even in The Haunting of Hill House, and Tanana Reeve's, you know, in the background there, if you look, she's got her poster for The Good House, which
you saw that?
Which is a really great novel, but like that book is about a woman who is living with the memory of, what is it, her grandmother?
Yes,
who,
her grandmother.
Her grandmother who lived in this house and had this reputation in town for decency and goodness and helping people. And yet there's this other wave of darkness that can creep in. And both of, in Dr. Sleep and The Good House, like it's about characters who are trying to measure themselves against the past. Am I going to be as good as this person who put me on my path? Am I going to be as bad as this person who put me on my path? Like, you know, and I think somebody like Harold is, he's kicked around a little bit by life. He's overweight. He's a nerd. He doesn't really fit in. He's awkward. Some of that's his own doing. Some of it's not. And we see him make choices that push him toward the darker side. And I think one thing King really understands is that people aren't naturally good or evil. They can really push each other and follow a little trail of breadcrumbs toward one path or the other. A character I hate to say I like this guy, but like Lloyd Henry.
Lloyd's great. Yeah.
He and Poke, that scene with Poke and him, you know, Poke has a gun and he's like, I'm going to pokerize you. Like those two, well, reading it again now, I realize how much of that is drawn from Hunter S. Thompson and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. These two guys cruising down a lonely road in a giant shark-shaped car, just their trunk is full of drugs and they're armed to the teeth. Only these guys are homicidal instead of self-destructive. And how cinematic their robbery scene in that little gas station was.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Just the shootout and the bubblegum machine exploding and spilling the bubblegum balls everywhere. Like, you know, and Poke getting half his face shot off and like arguing with the guy who shot him. And like, it's crazy. And then Lloyd walking out and the police are arriving. He's like, oh, I don't know. Boy, there's somebody. Yeah. it was like, it had that King weirdly funny, but like extreme, almost like a Breaking Bad type of tone to it, where it goes so dark that it almost becomes absurd. And you realize that these two guys, the way the story begins, well, they've already had a kill spree and they've stolen this car, but they were just sort of two low level creeps at a minimum security penitentiary. And they kind of worked each other up into a lather. So I think like what we see today, it's not necessarily related to COVID, but it's maybe related to our own political system and attitudes, is people can work each other up into and bring out the worst in each other. And they can also bring out the best. But the worst is easier. It's easier to spark that fire.
And I think you bring up a wonderful point about how King approaches characters, because there isn't an obvious difference in the backstories or in where these characters begin as to who is good or who is bad. And it's not, if we were reading this for the first time and we don't know kind of where the story goes, you can make assumptions throughout that are going to be wrong about the trajectory of a character. It's never that simple. And I think what I love about the way King approaches all of his characters are that, you know, for the most part, and there are exceptions to this, but for the most part, nobody's just inherently and explicitly good or bad. The difference between the good and the evil characters in his world are what they do. And, you know, you can have a character that you have enormous sympathy for all the way up until that inflection point where they make that decision, and that action makes them a villain. You know, in the same way you can have, like, Larry's not being set up to be a hero here. Mm-hmm. You know, on a first read, you know, I would guess Larry's on his way to Vegas. Larry's going to be there partying with Flag. But that's not the case. And it's all because of what he does. And this upending of expectations with people happens even more when we meet, we haven't even met Nadine, you know, who's going to be a great example of this for us, who can go either way, you know? I hope it's in the book, because I only remember the scene from the miniseries, but one of the things that struck me even as a kid was when, you know, Stuart finally meets Mother Abigail and confesses that he's an atheist, you know, and he said, I don't believe in God. And she just laughs at him and says, that's okay, he believes in you. And that's fine with her, you know, like it's a really interesting kind of way to upend your expectations for the traditional heroes and villains. But I think that idea that all of us, you know, for the most part in our lives, are carrying around very untested virtue. And it takes a cataclysmic or catalyzing event, like a global pandemic in this case for these characters, to really kind of force that decision, to force them to define themselves the only way we mortal human beings can actually define ourselves, which is by what we do. And we can say what we believe or what we think we would do or what we would prefer we do, or we can say I am good or I am bad. And the only thing that ultimately matters is what we do. And I think that's something that, you know, King approaches his characters with that empathy in a really profound way in this book, more than, you know, more than almost any other of his that I can imagine, acts that out.
Yeah. I love that. And that is so true. And it's not just, it's what you do and also sometimes why you do it, right? Because if we go back to the scene with Franny and that horrible blow up when she confesses that she's pregnant and her mom freaks out, her mom was wrong to hit her. Absolutely. But also her dad was wrong to hit her mom. You know, I was sort of heartbroken in that moment. And I don't know that it was meant to seem like it was a violation, even the way it was written. It was hard to tell, because all of us are thinking, well, she had it coming, you know, but it's also not okay, right? And it made me sad for the entire family, for Franny, but also especially for him, because I'm sure what a huge disappointment he must have been to himself in that moment, right? I can only assume. But in terms of which character, they all really get under my skin. I sink into Franny's pages, I sink into Nick's pages, but for some reason, both on second reading and in this reading, there's something about Larry. You know, there's this meme going around now where people say, like, your plans for 2020, and then when 2020 hits, like, it's like one photo, you're bright and shiny, and the next photo, you're beat to hell. And this idea that he's just breaking out, that he's finally got his hit on the radio when the world falls apart. There are so many of us who feel that way, right? Like, I have my first TV episode coming, where my husband and Stephen Barnes and I wrote an episode of The Twilight Zone that's going to come out. Thank goodness it was already.
Oh, that's amazing. Congratulations.
Right? Well, thank you. Well, you feel like you're getting like that claw finger hold, and then Hollywood disappears. You know, it's almost
all the doors funny. Shut. Yeah.
Everything just disappears. I mean, it will come back, but it's just this moment. It feels so much like what it would be like to be Larry Underwood. You finally have a hit on the radio. He's even just trying to get his life together. So he's trying to move away from the party scene and get himself in order and get psyched up to do his next album, all the things he's supposed to be doing. And none of that is going to matter. And I want to go back quickly to something you said, Anthony, about the casual racism in some of the characters. And thank you for bringing that up, because I don't know how I reacted as a teenager. I think back when I read it, I often was just happy if Black people were acknowledged that we exist. So I don't remember jarring at the N-word so much as I do now, because now we're in more sensitive times, and I just didn't remember like so many of the characters being casually racist. But the moment that Larry came through for me was when his mom had used the N-word, and then he didn't have an immediate reaction, but later on he had an internal memory of his mom's bigotry. So that to me is a signal, oh, okay, he notices too. He doesn't like it either. You know, we're in this together kind of thing. So there is a judgment. There's a judgment attached to it, rather than it just sort of being color that's not commented upon. You know, these are colorful characters and this is how they think and talk. But Larry does, you know, at least make a slightly anti-racist thought there when he's thinking about his mom. But at the same time, having had a very close relationship with my mother, those scenes where Larry is trying to navigate that very prickly relationship he has with his mom and trying to reach for his better angels. And the conflict between, as you guys were saying, who we are and who we want to be, all of that is really, really strong for me in Larry's sections. You know, we all want to feel like we're the hero in somebody's story. But, you know, if you've lived a while, you've had some moments where you have been the villain in somebody's story. It's not a moment you're proud of, but we all have that thing we wince when we think about. And who are we really? You know, how do we overcome those flaws and our selfishness and all those things about us that our moms remind us? You know, you're a taker. You're a taker, Larry.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Another scene, by the way, that's not actually in the original text, that scene where Larry's mom tells him finally at work what she really thinks of him is not in the original text. I would say that scene, the scene with Franny's mom and the scene with Vic Palfrey where he's having the hallucinations, are the three moments in the first 24 chapters that made me actually like choke up and want to cry. Like my eyes like welled up with tears as I was reading them. And I just thought, how is it possible that these had to be excised from the original? Because it's, to me, it's a much more heartbreaking version of the story to have those moments in there.
What I think is interesting about him and is the relationship with parents at the start of this and losing them, you know? Mm. Yeah. There are very few people who, and I don't think any, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, who lose their children, right? It's all people who lose the older generation. I guess Stu had a stillborn baby and really doesn't have anybody left.
And they talk about kind of children of characters you don't get to know well.
Right? Yeah.
Of the
survivors, of the immune people. Right. There's nobody who like loses their whole family and, you know, they're all sort of loners in a way. Yeah. And
I think
of King's history, you know, if you guys have read the short story, The Woman in the Room, about which he wrote about his mother dying from cancer. And I think it's sort of well known that he didn't have a father. He and his brother were raised by a single mom. The dad did one of those I'm going out and never came home things. And I think, from all I've read and in earlier interviews with him, that the death of his mother, when that's the only person you have in your life, really affected him. And then he has this, what I imagine is a notion of his father, at least, who abandoned them, right? So you often have one parent who means everything, like Franny and her father. And then there's Franny and her mother, who she has this super hostile feeling toward.
Yeah.
And Larry and his mother, who there's a little bit of ambivalence, but he really does care about her and want her to be happy and want her to respect him. But then these characters lose that person. They lose their mooring, and they're forced to go out into the world and figure things out. And I can't help but think that his own experience must have played a part in this. What happens when it's just you two and you lose that person, you know? Yeah. Got to be scary.
And also on that topic, with COVID being so much more dangerous to elderly populations and the kinds of horrible infection rates we're seeing in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, that notion of separation, like where you literally can't see that parent, if they're in the hospital, if they're in a facility, burials having to be done remotely, all the real life horror, right, is mirrored with that sense of losing your moorings with your family and your parents in the stand too.
Absolutely. Great point. You know, if I'd known better, I would have had us end on chapter 23 instead of chapter 24, because that really is where we first encounter Randall Flagg. And that chapter just is, it's sheer poetry. Like, and it makes sense that it would be poetry too, because Randall Flagg was born of a poem. The idea of Flagg originated from a poem that King wrote in 1969 called The Dark Man. Now, did anyone, for extra credit, read either The Dark Man or King's short story about Captain Tripp's Night Surf before diving into the sand?
No.
Did. Anthony.
Yeah, that's it's a short story from Night Shift.
Yeah.
And I don't remember it that vividly. I remember it being one of the weaker ones out of that. out of that book, but almost like a little, just it's almost like a little addendum to The Stand. It's just people hanging out at the beach, right? And they're talking about Captain Trips taking people away. And
pretty much it.
Like last dance at the before the lights go out, like at a party.
Yeah, it's totally true. It is, though. It is that chapter I found to be. It's completely unlike anything else that you've read in the book so far. It is, I mean, there's a lot of moments that King writes throughout The Stand that are very poetic, but that entire chapter is, you know, there's this, the first edition that came out. By the way, did anyone ever notice the fact that this never actually happens in the story? Like, who are those people? And I mean, we know who they are, but like, it's good versus, well, speaking of it looking good too. The other thing that I thought of recently, because I was like, gosh, this is such a great cover. And then it suddenly dawned on me. I was like, wait a minute, when was this book written? And, or when was it published? And I think that it was first published in 78.
78, I think it was.
So how much does this look like a blockbuster? But you can't see it, from 1977, called Star Wars. How much does this person look like?
Good point. This is good.
How much does this person
look? That's Luke Skywalker against Darth Vader.
Yeah, on Tatooine.
Yeah, on Tatooine with the big desert in the background. I was like, wait a minute. I'm like, I wonder if this came out right after what was the biggest movie in the history of the world at the time. And I'm sure that the marketing department was like, well, this is going to sell real well. That's super smart. But the back of the book actually has this, it has two paragraphs with that are taken from that Randall Flagg chapter. I just wanted to read the back of the book here for a second. And also it sort of, we're wrapping things up here, and I want to give Steve the final word on the matter too. So this is from that chapter, and it says, Randall Flagg, the dark man, strode south on US 51, listening to the night sounds that pressed close on both sides of this narrow road that would take him sooner or later out of Idaho and into Nevada. From Nevada, he might go anywhere. It was his country, and none knew or loved it better. He knew where the roads went, and he walked them at night. He hammered along, arms swinging by his sides. He was known, well known, along the highways in hiding that are traveled by the poor and by the mad, by the professional revolutionaries, and by those who have been taught to hate so well that their hate shows on their faces like hare lips. And they are unwelcome, except by others like them, who welcome them to cheap rooms with slogans and posters on the wall, to basements where lengths of sawed-off pipe are held in padded vices while they are stuffed with high explosives, to back rooms where lunatic plans are laid to kill a cabinet minister, to kidnap the child of a visiting dignitary, or to break into a boardroom meeting of Standard Oil with grenades and machine guns and murder in the name of people. He was known there, and even the maddest of them could only look at his dark and grinning face at an oblique angle. The women he took to bed with him, even if they had reduced intercourse to something as casual as getting a snack from the refrigerator, accepted him with a stiffening of the body, a turning away of the countenance. Sometimes they accepted him with tears. They took him the way they might take a ram with golden eyes or a black dog. And when it was done, they were cold, so cold it seemed impossible they could ever be warm again. Poetry. It is absolute poetry. It feels completely different to me than a lot of the other chapters that we've read so far. Did you feel that it was different in any way, just in the terms of its prose?
Yeah, totally agree. It leaps out, I think, because of how matter of fact everything that precedes it is, which is, I think, part of what makes it so propulsive. And so now that you've introduced this character, who's the first character on screen who isn't a human being, you know, I think that, yeah, like you said, the poetry is starting to poke out. Because I was struck by how, especially in the early chapters, it is very very clinical. It's just, and then they did this and then they did that, which is still wonderful. It's wonderfully written, but it's keeping an arm's length to a lot of it from a, you know, from a writing point of view. I think maybe because he's killing the world, so you can't swim in its poetry and then kill it.
It's funny. I noticed that too. I noticed that there's a lot of, he doesn't get real, highfalutin with his, it's very no nonsense prose, in many areas. Like I found whole paragraphs where it was just short sentences explaining what was happening. And as a writer, that struck me. I was like, that's interesting that he can do that. And then in the process of that, almost like in the process of what's probably, I'm going to guess, like a stream of consciousness, sort of just short sentence, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then that happened. Eventually in there somewhere, there's one sentence that's just sheer poetry, but it's like, well, it only takes one, you know, like you don't have to make every single sentence like something that's, you know, expounding on more than is necessary. It's very... Well,
no, it is. It is. It's a huge turning point in the story. This is our first wholly supernatural character, right? We've had hints of dreams up to this point, but this is the first time we're seeing what is the difference between a long novel, which is a novel with great, very well-drawn characters and deep into their lives, and an epic novel, which is what The Stand is, because all of this characterization and even the plague is just a backstory leading to this larger story with Flag at the center of it. So it has a lot of weight on its shoulders. It's sort of steering this ship toward what this novel is really about.
Yeah, very true.
I think it's interesting you draw that comparison between, or that distinction between the prose of the Randall Flagg chapter, because King does this thing often in his works that I think is really kind of fun, where he throws in something that banal or almost commercial-like. He'll mention a product or a TV show that really seems, it's a contrast in absurdity to whatever seriousness is going on. You know, like when Larry is walking through New York and looking through the store windows at the TVs that are on, and like CBS has like a test pattern up, and then there are just a bunch of other like sitcoms that are just clearly whatever tape they had that they could run just to fill the airtime. And I forget the shows that he mentioned, but it's all pretty silly stuff. And then there's this sequence where Polk and Lloyd are having their shootout in the gas station, and he describes shooting the cowboy, like the patron who just has a gun, I guess the good guy with a gun who pops out to try to settle things. And Lloyd ends up shooting him, and it says like he put three bullet holes in the cowboy's khaki shirt, and most of his innards exited from the back to splatter a Budweiser sign that showed the world famous Clydesdales. And I thought most writers would end with sprayed the Budweiser sign, but he adds that showed the world famous Clydesdales. And it's just like a little like, oh yeah, you know, this thing that we see on TV or in ads all the time, like it just grounds it in a way and puts it in your face. And the Randall Flagg chapter comes in, and it's got this almost scripture like grandiloquence to it, that you realize all those little details that he threads through are to make it feel like this is our world. This is the real world. This is the 7-Eleven, not a gothic castle far away. But then here comes this gothic element that feels very different tonally. It's got that Ray Bradbury prose, you know, that's really going deep, reaching for some sort of depth. And it almost reminds me of the comic books. Whenever Thor speaks, it's in a different, it's like in a more fancy font because it projects his accent, you know? And it's like, so it's the opposite of what King does. And he does it in the Dark Tower books too. It's another world. So he writes in a different style. There's not this casual reference to pop culture or to products. You know, I think it's kind of cool.
It's amazing. Mike, Tanana Reeves, Anthony, thank you so much for joining me. Next month, we'll be discussing chapters 25 through 42, which will take us all the way through the end of book one. You can get notified of when new episodes go live by subscribing at thestandpodcast.com. You'll also find links to Tanana Reeve Dew's online course, My Horror Fiction, and Anthony Breznican's first look at CBS's The Stand for Vanity Fair. And as we close today's episode, The Stand podcast asks you to take a stand. We urge you to help New York City's first responders of the COVID-19 pandemic. The EMS FDNY Help Fund helps first responders battling medical issues, debilitating injuries, and personal tragedies. During this unprecedented pandemic, it is unfortunate but inevitable that some first responders will become infected with the virus. And when that happens, we need to be there for them. The EMS FDNY Help Fund is providing the vital gear and supplies to protect emergency medical technicians, paramedics, and other first responders for the city of New York. Your financial contribution can ensure the welfare of the city's finest heroes who put their lives on the line every single day in the epicenter of this pandemic. Go to thestandpodcast.com, scroll down, and make a donation today. Don't wait. Don't do it tomorrow. Don't do it 10 minutes from now. Do it right now. Go to thestandpodcast.com, scroll down, and give whatever you can. Until next time, remember the place where you make your stand doesn't matter, only that you do, and that you're still on your feet.